very nice to be here, and I thank Giulio for having invited me to this fantastic institution. It's the first time for me here, and it's been really a fantastic experience up to now. So today I would like to tell you briefly about some research I've been doing in the last year, more or less. And it's about essentially applying some fairly old ideas from classical statistics into the quantum setting. So my pretext, my starting point, was somehow the ideas behind resource theoretical frameworks, which have turned out to be extremely useful in order to capture some deep properties of quantum theory with respect to other theories. So how does a resource theory work? So essentially you start by identifying a resource, and this can be actually somehow the trickier task to formalize, but when you see it, it's very sort of natural thing. And once you identify the resource as something valuable in your theory, then you characterize processes which are allowed for free. So those transformations that do not require that resource in order to be implemented. And then another thing that you want to introduce is a set of resource measures that essentially tell you how much resource is contained in a resource carrier, which can be whatever. I don't want to say quantum physics or whatever, because this framework is extremely general. And one thing that these measures should satisfy, if you want them to be meaningful in this setting, is that they monotonically decrease under the action of an allowed process. Because an allowed process do not use any new resource, so it cannot introduce any new resource in the system, and by the fact that your resource cannot be created for free, if not the whole resource theory you are building is completely meaningless, this tells you that the amount of resource can only decrease, and if you are lucky, they will stay the same. Now, there is a problem, and it's the problem to characterize, to understand how we can know whether a transformation is allowed or not. So we know what are allowed processes, but we don't know whether you can transform a resource carrier into another. So usually you only have a set of necessary conditions, and these conditions are given by your measures, and it's very simply done in this way. So you just have to compute the measures for your two carriers, and if the measures are larger for one with respect to the other, then you can hope, actually you're not ruling out the possibility of having a transformation between the two. But the condition is only necessary, as I told you. So for those very lucky resource theories, you have also a reversibility idea. And this tells you that the non-increase of resource measures is not only necessary, but also sufficient for the existence of a transformation between two carriers. The golden standard of this sort of resource theories is equilibrium thermodynamics, where everything is as beautiful as it can be, in the sense that you have a total ordering, in the sense that you just need one measure of your resource carriers. In this case, resource is heat or energy, and the carriers are equilibrium states. And you just have to check whether the entropy of one state is greater than the entropy of another, just to know that actually there exists a transformation from the latter to the former state via an adiabatic process, which are exactly those processes that do not require any external source of heat to be done. Recently, another resource theory, or well, another theory was proved to have a meaning as a resource, as a reversible resource theory, which is the theory of entanglement, just to tell you one example. And this was done by Fernando Brandão and Martin Plenio when they found that the relative entropy of entanglement essentially completely characterized the possibility of interconversion between sequences of bipartite states under this very tricky set of operations, which are so-called separability-preserving operations. Anyway, it is kind of difficult to construct a resource theory which is also reversible. And my starting point was very ambitious, and what I've got is just a sort of very partial solution to it. And it was to try to find how far you can go if you want to find a reversible resource theory of information and a reversible resource theory of non-locality. So in this talk, I will tell you what I discovered about these two possibilities. And as far as statistical decision theory is concerned, we will consider the operational tasks as being statistical decision problems. I will introduce you or recall you what they are. Resource carriers, the resource itself can be thought as information, and the carriers are statistical models, essentially ensembles of quantum states. And allowed processes, well, essentially are completely positive trace-preserving maps, but what we need in order to completely characterize these theories is a more general concept, and it is given by this particular maps that I will explain to you what they mean. And measures are given by so-called information values. So what I will be doing here is to adapt to something which is well known in classical statistics to the case of quantum theory. And as far as non-locality instead is concerned, then I will try to introduce some non-locality values even in terms of non-local gains and show that the monotonicity of such non-locality values can tell you, can give you a set of sufficient and necessary conditions about the existence of a local operation with shared randomness between the two bipartite states.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
So in the definition of reversible resource theory, the number of these resource measures is finite, or it can be?
Oh, this is a good question. So. It depends on the kind of ordering you are imposing on your resource carriers. So, for example, if you have only one measure, then the order is complete, is total, in the sense that you can just pick two states. But you can have more than one. Now, I'm not concerned about them to be finite or not. Actually, they will turn out to be actually an uncountable number of conditions.
But in that case, any resource theory will be, by this definition, a reversible resource theory, because you can always find infinite number of monotones which give necessary and sufficient condition for transformation. For example, the maximum probability of, for example, transforming one state. For any final state, you can define a possible monotone.
Which depends only on the state. That would be some sort of relative monotone. So you should put in this function both states.
So you label.
Well, this is just a set of functions which are computed separately for each state.
Yep.
And then just considering whether they decrease, then you have necessary sufficient conditions.
Yeah, I mean, you label your functions by the possible final state, and that is specify your function.
You label your function.
So you're allowed an uncountable number of measures. Mm-hmm. So here's an uncountable number of measures. For every state in space, you say, what's the maximum probability of getting to psi 1? What's the maximum probability of getting to psi 2? What's the maximum probability of getting to psi 3? And you go through all the states, and that's an uncountable number of measures.
All right. So, well, let's say that this is given in terms of some... All right. So, well, let's say that these are not so straightforward things. So they are defined in terms of a set of games you can play with your resources, statistical games. Maybe if you just let me go a little bit further.
So you mean in your particular case these are not perfect for?
Yes, in my particular case.
But in general,
yes, of course.
They would be.
it's analogous to something that, for example, has been done for entanglement catalytic transformations, where you have a set of conditions that tells you where you can, it's called tramping condition, and you just have to check whether all, for example, Reni entropies of the reduced state of one state are larger than the Reni entropies of the reduced state of the other state. So somehow, yes, they're a bit less trivial than, but thank you. Okay, so statistical decision theory in classical statistics is given by before specifying a statistical model, which is given by a parameter set, which is usually interpreted as the set of possible states of nature that you want to learn about. Then it's given by a state space, which is the state space of a classical system in general. And typically one state of this classical system would be given by a probability distribution on the state space. So you're considering probabilistic states. And then you have a function, which is called an experiment, which is a mapping between this set of parameters into probabilistic states of your physical system. So equivalently, you can describe a statistical model essentially as a family of probability distributions. And the statistical game, or sometimes is equivalently called statistical decision problem, then gives you an action set from which you have to choose one decision or one action according to a decision function or an observation function, which is just a function going from probabilistic states into probability distributions on the action set. And then you have a payoff, which is given to you depending on the value of the true parameter theta and the decision you took. So essentially the flowchart of a statistical game is given as follows. So you start with the unknown state of nature, if you want, and then experiment creates a probabilistic state of a physical system. And then through a decision, you actually get a probability distribution depending on theta on the action set. And then you will be given a payoff, which is in average computed in this way. And then you introduce a function, which is usually called the information value of a statistical model with respect to the statistical gain G, given in this way. So you maximize overall possible decision, the sum of this expected payoff. Now, you have defined an information value of a statistical model for a given game. So now it's meaningful to compare two statistical models with respect to the same game. So how well you can play a game if you're given one statistical model or another. And this is what it's done in this definition. So you can say that, so you're given two statistical models, E and F, and they're both about the same unknown parameter, right? Because it makes sense to compare things which are about the same natural phenomenon. But they could have a different state space. So they could be statistical models on different physical systems, actually. And then you say that one statistical model E is more informative than another, always, and you write it in this way, if the information value of E is greater than the information value of F for all possible statistical gains G. Another relation that you can actually introduce is the relation so-called of sufficiency. So one statistical model is sufficient for another if there exists a stochastic transformation, which is just a thin mapping from probability distributions on the state space into probability distribution on another state space. And so it tells you that if you have a statistical model and you apply a stochastic transformation, you are only getting a sort of shuffling of your initial statistical model. And it is essentially straightforward to prove that the original statistical model is always better than what you obtain by shuffling its states. And a very important theorem in classical statistics, which is called the Blackwell-Shermanstein theorem, tells you that these two orderings that you introduce, so the information ordering between statistical models and the sufficiency ordering between statistical models, are equivalent. So E is better than F if and only if there exists a stochastic transformation that maps E into F. So now what I would like to do is to extend this concept to quantum sensing. And this is very easily done, at least as far as definitions are concerned. So you introduce quantum statistical model. Well, this was as done by Holevo in his 1973 paper on quantum statistical decision theory. So I'm not inventing anything. So you still have a parameter set. Now the state space, the state set is replaced by a Hilbert space, and probability distributions are replaced now by density matrices acting on H. And again, you can define a quantum statistical game now, where the rules are exactly the same, so you still have an action set, X. You have still a payoff function that tells you how much you gain or lose if it is negative, right? If the true parameter was some theta and if your action was some X. The only difference is that now these affine functions from states to probability distributions are well known to be given by POVMs. So the flowchart of a quantum statistical game starts from an unknown parameter, which is encoded in a family of quantum states. Then you apply a POVM, you get a conditional probability distribution, and you get an expected payoff. And again, you can define the information value now of an ensemble of quantum states for a given statistical gain G in this form. And again, as we did before, you can introduce a notion of information ordering between ensembles of quantum states. And this is given very simply in this way. So you say that R is better than S if and only if the information value of R is greater than that of S for all quantum statistical gains. And again, if you imagine that now your stochastic transformations are replaced by completely positive trace preserving maps, it's extremely easy to prove that actually for any statistical model R and any completely positive trace preserving map, R is always better than the processed version of itself. The problem is that now we know for sure that there exist quantum statistical models which are in this relation, but for which there exists no completely positive trace preserving map between the two. So you cannot generalize the quantum, the Blackwell-Shermanstein theorem to the quantum setting straightforward. You need something more. A counterexample is very easily given by considering a rich enough family of states and its transposed version. Rich enough, I mean that you can be sure that only the transposition exists between the two sets. Now, the transposition is not completely positive, and yet the transposed of a state is a state, the transposed of a POVM is a POVM, and the trace is invariant under the transposition. So essentially, you can get exactly the same statistics and exactly the same payoff from an ensemble and it's transposed. So this tells you that at least you can construct a positive trace preserving map. And you would hope, so are positive trace preserving map then enough? And yet the answer is no. So we have explicit counterexamples where ensembles are ordered in this way, but you can prove that there exists no positive trace preserving maps mapping the two. So we need something more. And what is this concept? It's that of statistical morphism, which is something that lifts the condition of positivity and only focuses on the statistical relation between ensembles and POVNs. So let's go through this definition. So you start from a statistical, quantum statistical model on H, and then you take a linear map lambda from operators on H onto operators on K. And you say that this map induces a statistical morphism of R if and only if these two conditions are satisfied. First condition is that lambda applied on each of the rho theta gives you another state, so positive and norm and with trace equal to 1 on K. And another condition is that for any POVM on K, which is the output space, there exists a corresponding POVM on H such that the statistics are the same. This is barely what you need in order to have a data processing inequality. Nothing more than that, because this tells you that, you see here, any POVM that you can perform on here gives rise to exactly the same input-output probability distribution for some POVM on H. So for sure, you can reach from R at least the same payoff that you can reach from the processed version of R. Now instead, what you can prove is really this equality. So the non-commutative Blackwell-Shermanstein theorem, notice that I'm saying non-commutative, not yet quantum, because somehow I have these funny maps here, lambda, and I would like to go back to the completely positive first preserving case before really claiming that I'm proving any sort of quantum version of the Blackwell-Shermanstein theorem. But in any case, if your family of probability distributions are replaced by families of non-commuting density matrices, then still you can prove that this information ordering here now is equivalent to the existence of a statistical morphism between the two families of states. Now, I think that many of you know that in the literature or historically, people started considering positive maps, also called stochastic maps on states, and positive maps on POVM. Until somebody recognized the role of complete positivity in quantum theory. So then they discovered theorems that gives you conditions for the extension of a positive trace-preserving map to a completely positive trace-preserving map. And these are essentially about the mapping of an algebra into an abelian one. Then you know that positivity is equivalent to complete positivity. Or you have another theorem, which is usually attributed to either Krauss or Choi, about the fact that if the extension of your map with the identity map is positive for all extensions, but actually you can truncate this chain at some point, then still you know that your map was actually completely positive. And these two theorems essentially extend in a very simple way these results to statistical morphisms. So actually you can lift the condition of positivity on these maps, and you can prove the same theorems for statistical morphisms. So the first extension theorem tells you that if you have two statistical models, so two families of quantum states, such that the second one is abelian, so such that all states in the second family are commuting. And if you know that there exists a statistical morphism from R to S, then you actually know that there exists a completely positive trace-preserving map that agrees on all the states in these families. The second dilation theorem, which is somehow the analog of the Krauss-Choi theorem for positive maps, tells you the following. That so now you want to compare still two families of quantum states, but now you introduce a third ancillary one, which plays the role of the extension in the Choi theorem. Okay? And now you look not simply about, you don't look simply at R and S alone, but you look at R composed with T and S composed with T. When this composition means that you are considering the family of density matrices, which are just the tensor product of the two. And now you consider T to be rich enough. So you want that the linear span of states in T actually span the whole space of linear operators. And then you have these three equivalent conditions. So you can check whether there is a statistical morphism from this extended family of states into this one. And you know that equivalently there exists a completely positive trace preserving map from this composed family to this one. But then simply because this state now constitute a faithful set of states, then you know that actually this map has the form of identity tensor something else. So actually you know for free that there exists another CPTP map that maps R into S. So now we are ready to really express some quantum versions of the Blacher-Schermerstein theorem. And the first one is given in this form and tells you that clearly, if you have two families of quantum states where the second one is abelian, then the information ordering is equivalent to the existence of a completely positive now processing of the family. So essentially, this theorem is a direct generalization of the Blackwell-Schermerstein theorem, because once you identify commuting quantum statistical models with classical statistical models, then you really have that the original one is about two families which such that both of them are abelian. So here we are able to lift the commutativity on one of them. And the other one, which is the more general one instead, tells you that these three conditions now are equivalent. So you do not only require that R is better than S, but you also require that R is better than S whenever they are composed with any other possible statistical model. But actually, if you go through the proof, you actually see that you only need a T which is complete in this sense. And these two are equivalent to the third one, which is the one we like. So once again, complete positivity is related with the possibility of extending. So here, what it means extend, it means to provide the players not only with R and S, but also with something more that you give to both of them. So if by providing them with the same additional extra quantum statistical model still leave the ordering between the same unchanged, then you can prove that there exists a completely positive trace preserving map. So let's move on to the second half of this talk, where I will be doing something very similar for bipartite states. And while before I consider the set of statistical games, now I will be considering it doesn't require a lot of imagination to consider the set of non-local games as the natural ones when you deal with bipartite states. So a non-local game is defined by providing four finite index sets, S, T, X, and Y, and a payoff function that goes from lists of index in S, T, X, and Y into real numbers. And the game works as follows. There is a referee and there are two separate players, Alice and Bob. And the referee asks them independently questions S and question T, and they have to reply with answers X and Y. However, before the game starts, well, after the game started, they cannot communicate in any way. But before the game started, they could agree on a strategy. And in quantum theory, this amounts to sharing a bipartite state. So they can actually keep aside an extra bipartite state, and by performing some measurements on it, they can try to increase the correlations between their answers. So in the following, just for notational convenience, I will think that actually this communication of questions happens through a quantum channel. So actually what the referee does is to send orthogonal states to Alice and Bob. And then, as we first introduced the information value of a family of density matrices for statistical gain, now here we can introduce non-locality value of a bipartite state with respect to a non-local gain. And this is given by the maximum expected payoff that Alice and Bob might hope to get out from a given rho AB. And as we did before, now we use all these possible gains to introduce an ordering between bipartite states. And we can say that one state, rho AB, is always more non-local than another. And we write it in this way, if and only if the non-locality value of rho is larger than the non-locality value of sigma for all non-local gains. So since non-local gains are equivalent to Bell's inequality, you can say that one state is more non-local than another with respect to all possible Bell inequalities. And then I focus on this set of operations, which are so-called local operations with shared randomness. In the PhD thesis of Gutowski. And they are defined in this way. So these are bipartite, completely positive trace-preserving maps that can be written as a convex combination of local, completely positive trace-preserving maps. Notice that both of them are trace-preserving. So these are a very restricted class of separable operations. In particular, well, they can always be simulated by a LOCC, but they do not require any communication to be realized. They only need shared randomness. So I thought it was natural, somehow natural, to consider this class of operations for, in order to deal with the non-locality ordering, because you do not have to allow any communication between the two. On the other hand, if you give them extra entanglement, so if they can do any local operation with shared entanglement, then you could easily change the non-locality order in between the two states. They could just prepare, for example, a maximally entangled state and locally swap it. While we know that shared randomness does not help you in violating Bell's inequality more than what you can do without shared randomness. So this is, in a sense, a shared randomness is a resource which is completely useless for playing non-local games. And in fact, it is again very simple to prove that for any bipartite state at any local operation with shared randomness phi, the original state is more non-local than its noisy version. Well, unfortunately, here again, we are not able to find the direct connection between these two orders. So, an ordering which is about non-local gains, non-locality ordering, and an ordering which is about the existence of an LOSR map between the two states. And actually, we can prove that there exist states which satisfy this relation, but for which there exists no LOSR map, such that one is the transformed of the other. We will see the reason why this is true later on. So before, in order to solve this sort of problem, I changed the map remember, from completely positive trace preserving map, I had to introduce statistical morphisms. Here the situation is a bit more tricky, and maybe, I have a conjecture at the end of the talk, but actually what I could do is to change the rules of the game slightly. So I needed to introduce this set of semi-quantum non-local games. So here, the referee is now allowed to communicate the questions to Alice and Bob using general quantum states. They are no more orthogonal in general now, while Alice and Bob are still bound to answer classical answers. And again, you can introduce, you can formally define semi-quantum non-local games by giving now four index sets as before, but now you have to give a bit more. So you have to give the family of states that the referee can communicate to Alice and the family of states on which the referee encodes the questions to Bob. And again, there is a payoff function like this. And you can define, you can just extend the non-locality value of your bipartite state to all these semi-quantum non-local games. Of course, semi-quantum non-local games contain usual non-local games as particular cases. And then you can introduce another comparison relation, ordering relation between bipartite states according to this new set of quantum games, by saying that one state is, I wouldn't say more non-local because non-locality is about Bell's inequality. So I wouldn't say anything, just give you the symbol here. It's more semi-quantum non-local, or I don't know. But satisfy this relation anyway, if and only if the expected payoff you get from R is greater from that you expect to get from sigma for all possible semi-quantum non-local games. And also in the case of semi-quantum non-local games, again, this inequality holds. And again, the proof is very easy. So the expected payoff can only go down by the application of local operation with shaped randomness. But now, if you extend the set of games, now you are able to prove an equivalence theorem, as we did before. So an analogous Blackwell theorem for non-locality somehow. So if you have any two bipartite states, rho and sigma, and if rho is better than sigma for all semi-quantum non-local games, then you are able to prove the existence of a local operation with shared randomness between the two. And we are able to already read some consequences. So first consequence is that separable states are the endpoints of the relation subset semi-quantum. Why? Because by local operations and shared randomness, you can create for free any separable state. So it means that if sigma A prime B prime is separable, there always exists an LOSR map file for any given rho AB. You just have to throw away rho AB and create sigma A prime B prime by means of phi. So it means that if this state is separable, this relation is true independently of what you put on the left-hand side. So here we are just essentially rediscovering the definition of separable states that were introduced by Werner as the states that do not exhibit any sort of non-locality. Right? So we would be extremely surprised if this wouldn't hold. So separable states are the least non-local states somehow. Another consequence you find is that all separable states have the same non-locality values for all possible semi-quantum non-local games. Again, for the same reason. Because if you have two separable states here, this relation holds in both ways. So it means that you can go from one to the other, or the other to the, from the former to the latter, and the latter from the former with different different maps. So it tells you that the expected payoff must be equal for all semi-quantum no-local games. Another easy consequence that you can derive is that a state Roy B now is entangled if and only if there exists a semi-quantum non-local game such that the payoff you get from Rho is strictly greater than what you get from all separable states. So this seems to be somehow similar to entanglement weaknesses, with the difference that these are not linear functions of the state. In fact, they are always, you see, they have the same value for all separable states.
Can you comment the difference? Because we know that there are entangled states thanks to Verne without log, right?
So, oh, yes. So we'll come to this one second. And in fact, this is the point. So the relation with only Bell inequalities alone, so really non-local games without this semi-quantum stuff, alone does not imply the existence of an L over S. And how do you see this? Exactly by considering these entangled states, which allow for a local hidden variable model. In particular, you can consider those which were found by Jonathan Barrett, which actually have a local hidden variable model for any POVN, local POVN measure, not only for von Neumann measure. So these states, as far as non-local games are concerned, they cannot perform better than any other separable state. So now imagine that actually this relation implies the existence of a local operation with shared randomness. That would mean that you could go from a separable state to this sort of entangled local hidden variable state with a local operation with shared randomness. But you cannot create any entanglement with only shared randomness. So this must not be possible. So this exactly tells you that the role of this, so essentially the separation between non-local games and semi-quantum games is completely equivalent to the separation between separable states and local hidden variable model entangled states. So the gap between the two concepts is exactly given by, can be, how can I say, it's kind of compactly described by this. So if you allow the referee to ask quantum questions to Alice and Bob, then you find that non-locality is entanglement, essentially. So only if you bind the referee to ask classical labels to Alice and Bob, then you find that there exist entangled local states. So also something else that I would like to argue, in fact, is that sort of game theoretical approach, this form, maybe trying to go deeper into this separation between non-local games and semi-quantum non-local games could possibly lead to some understanding of the relation between separable state and local state, or if you want, between entanglement and non-locality. So concluding remarks. So first I would like to propose you a conjecture. So what can we say now about the dynamical equivalent of the non-locality order? So if semi-quantum non-local games are concerned, then the correct map somehow, so the map that completely characterizes the payoff for semi-quantum non-local games are those maps which are local operation and shared randomness. So essentially it means that you give to your players the ability to share a separable state and then act locally on their half of the state plus this ancilla, correlated ancilla, classically correlated ancilla. And in particular, separable states are those states which come from for free in this operational scenario of semi-quantum non-local games, because they have all the same non-locality value. They are so-called like rubbish states. So now, what are the rubbish states for non-local games? Exactly, all local states, so comprising also entangled local states. So just by mere analogy, I have absolutely no other reason to believe that this conjecture might be true, but one would like maybe to have the fantasy that now the non-locality ordering, this one, so this tells you that rho is more non-local than sigma for all Bell inequalities, is true if and only if there exists a LHV POV map mapping rho and sigma, where these maps are those that can be written as local operations on the state tensorized by an ancilla, which is a state that allows a local hidden variable description. So essentially, by providing the players the ability to share a rubbish state, so let's call it this way, they might be able to close this sort of no-locality theory by using these extra resources. But I don't know, I have no idea. So in summary, okay, so maybe motivating this research in terms of resource theories was not the best choice, but in any case, so what I showed you and maybe what I hoped I convinced you about is that considering an operational setting where you can play some games can provide you with conditions which are extremely powerful to understanding whether you can transform one state into another. And actually we found out something about statistical decision problems where the resources are given in terms of ensembles of states and you want to transform an ensemble into another. And also we could say something about non-locality where we found that a class, an extended class of non-local games completely characterizes the possibility of mapping one bipartite state into another by means of local operation with shared randomness. And this is all, and thank you very much for your attention.
We have time for questions.
I have two questions. First, the way you define statistical morphism, it looks that they are not necessarily, they don't need to be positive maps. But in the example you gave about the transposing, it looks in that example at least you don't need to go beyond positive maps.
Oh, yes, that example has only positive map. In fact,
but you know examples that you yes. need to go beyond positive
yes. maps. Yes, I have explicitly. They are related with this. Alberti-Ullmann condition about the transformability of two states into another pair of states. And these conditions are given in terms of discrimination problems between the two states. So you want that one pair of states is always more discriminable for all a priori probability than another pair of states. So if these are qubit states, then you know that this is sufficient and necessary for the existence of a channel between the two. And this was proved by Alberti and Ullmann back in 83, I suppose. But we know that, before there was a counterexample about the non-existence of a completely positive trace-specific map. But using this framework, you can actually construct states for which there exists a statistical morphism, but for which there exists no positive trace-specific. And we have it explicitly written down.
I
have
another question. In the monotones you define, they are all based on payoff function, which is a linear function in a conditional probability. Mm-hmm. So you can also define monotones which are non-linear in mm-hmm. probability distribution. So do you think it doesn't tell you anymore?
There is the hope that you can, for example, simplify these conditions. As you said, an uncountable number of conditions is not, well, you can always find an uncountable number of conditions that tells you the thing, but it depends on how this uncountability comes into game. For example, in this nice example of entanglement catalytic transformations, they are uncountable because you have to check all Reni entropies for all values, real values of alpha. But there is only one parameter varying. So they are still very nicely characterizable. And they are nonlinear. I have no clue whether you could do something similar in this scenario, really. But that would be kind of fantastic thing to find.
It seems reasonable that for a finite dimension on Liberty space, if you put a link on the side of Liberty space, then you need to check finite number of payoff or finite number of quantum.
I have no intuition about it.
So just by the curiosity, a very vague question maybe. So there is some work by, I think, Yankova and Petz on sufficient subalgebras.
Oh, yes.
Where I think the idea is that if you have statistical models, you can always find a smaller subalgebra, which also gives you the best information that you can get somehow. Mm-hmm. Is this related to this?
Oh, yes, of course. I mean, sufficiency is the existence of a map. Mm-hmm. The fact is that Petz, I think that in the works of Petz, you can relax. So he starts with the existence of a, he says, coarse graining. And everything is about what this coarse graining satisfies. What are the properties that this coarse graining satisfies? So there are some algebraic properties that these maps have to satisfy. I think that they are able to relax this condition up to 2 positivity. So you do not need complete positivity, but you can go down and relax your theorems up until you have these maps to be 2 positive. So just if you take a copy of your algebra, they are still positive.
Okay. And these would be morphisms in your sense as well?
These are somehow more general. So that's why they allow me to give a weaker definition of sufficiency that allows me to prove that equivalence theorem. And then put physics back by hand into the theory by asking that to be completely positive. And what I found is that condition about the commutativity of states and the extendibility of an experiment. But somehow, the thing that I find particularly interesting is that there is a neat separation between what is statistics here and what is physics. And the two things are not equivalent, because statistics itself only gives you statistical morphisms. But if you want complete positivity, then you need something more.
So, maybe this is more of a comment than a question, but it seems to me that your formalism is also the right place to start to develop a resource theory for textuality, not just non-locality. And so I think in particular when you find the maps from the quantum experiment of commutative algebra. When you get the commutative algebra, you're basically mapping your quantum states onto diagonal states and therefore mm-hmm. probability distributions.
Yes.
And if you can simulate a POVM on your original set of quantum states by some POVM on that commutative algebra, well, that the property of being a POVM on commutative algebra now turns into being a likelihood function in your classical model. Mm-hmm. So you're really asking about whether you can model all your states and your POVMs by classical probability distributions,
oh, yes.
classical likelihood functions, and it has to be a one-to-one map, and that's a non-contextual model. Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious if you've thought in that direction.
No. This actually, the second part about non-locality is pretty recent, so there are still many things to be done there, and this is definitely very interesting.
So wanted to point out the possible connection with something that people have studied in cryptography mm-hmm. that is called squashing. Mm-hmm. It's where you pretend that you are dealing with qubits. I mean, especially when you measure, although maybe you are receiving light, that means it's an infinite dimensional system. So in fact, what people do is actually whether you can substitute essentially one model with the other, right? So you can really imagine that you are measuring. and at a certain point we were studying, they are still studying what are the conditions under which it's possible to think of a squashing and simplifies the cryptographic analysis. So you may want to check that. And the second thing is, have you tried anything for the multipartite case?
Oh, no.
Not yet?
No.
Because there are funny things that happen in the multipartite.
I imagine so. The point, so maybe this could try to give you already some insight. So here the POVMs are local, but the map that comes out at the end is local plus shared random. So it means that you are entitled to have any sort of local thing, convex combination of local things, basically, right? So why? Because here you are forcing them to be local. And then you need somehow to convexify these strategies. So you have to put a probability distribution on these local things. And actually what you have at the end is a convex combination of local operations. So I don't know, maybe it could be that also in the multipartite setting, as far as the players are they're all separated, it could be that still you are able to find local operation with shared randomness, where now the randomness is shared between all players of the game. That could be possible. But I don't know, I didn't go into the topic, and I know that very strange things happen when you have multipartite settings. So this is just my hunch now, but I could be well wrong.
So in the last point where you're talking about using rubber states that satisfy, that can be simulated by local invariant models as sort of free ancillas to determine the non-locality in your resource state.
Yes.
So I'm not so familiar with this literature, but it would surprise me if somebody had shown that some of these bipartite states that admit local invariant models for POVMs are such that if you take a pair of them, all of a sudden you do violate the Bell equality.
Yes.
And if that's true, then it seems to me just by showing that your resource state violates Bell equality with this quote rubber state,
yes,
you have to show that the non-locality is there.
Of course.
It could be unlocking the non-locality that was in your rubber state, and so you sort of miscategorized where the resource is lying.
Okay, I thought about it. Actually, this would be related to the fact that non-locality cannot be activated, because this would tell you that you always go down, right? So if you give them rubbish states, local states, you always go down. But actually, there is this paper that shows that two states which do not violate an inequality, actually, when they're put together, they violate. But these are not local states. These are local only with respect to that particular Bell inequality. So those are not in this category. So they're not rubbish at all. They could be very nice states, only for that particular game, which is, by the way, the CHSH.
So is that category defined in such a way that, you know, with any number of copies of this state, you can violate any Bell inequality? Is that?
No, I think that Barrett showed that just that you have one copy of the state and any local measurement you can compute, the joint probability distribution of any local measurement you can compute can be written as a convex combination of some local probability distributions.
But the point is that you can use now the other state to perform, let's say, if you want measurements that are not local, right? So depending on
the state which
is
given, the row, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And so the claim, the conjecture would tell you that by supplying a state with some rubbish state and then acting locally, you can never increase its non-locality features somehow.
So I'll just have them again because I haven't quite seen how you answered the question. So if the class of states that you're referring to, rubber states, are such that it's possible that two copies of them could violate the Bell inequality, whereas one copy is not, then it seems to me that you could take a state row, which is just it unlocks the non-locality in your rubbish state. It has no non-locality itself. No number of copies of it would violate the Bell inequality, but it unlocks the non-locality in your rubbish state. And so you think of it as a resource according to your definition, but that's inappropriate. It's only a resource insofar as it, you know, can unlock the non-locality in something else. So that's my concern.
I see your point. Yeah. That would be a direction maybe to disprove this contention. That might be much easier to do than prove it.
Technical question on that particular paper regard. So, just if you remember, so can you say that this non-local, these rubbish states can be obtained? These rubbish states are such that you can obtain them from a classically correlated state by applying a classical to quantum transition map.
I don't know. I thought about it, but
if they are really degradation of class, if the sense in which he says that...
No, because they're entangled, first of all. So they're not separable states. So they are entangled states, but for which, if you just measure them locally, you get something which could be described by classical local...
But apparently there is a map that for every couple of UVMs,
No, no. The mixing probability is the same. The hidden variable is always the same.
Exactly. So this looks like a simulation, like your case of a statistic.
Yeah, but you know, these probabilities could come from very strange mechanism. I mean, this non-local variable could be however you want. I mean, must not be some sort of just a label. Yes. Could have some.
What I meant is that if it were that way, from local tomography, you could construct the same map for when you have couples of states. So this would automatically prove that the tensor product of two rubbish states is a rubbish.
Ah, right. Answering rough questions.
This was an attempt to. Uh-huh. But this depends on actually how
Yeah. We should try to look better into. Actually, it's a very technical paper and it's not easy to follow. I mean, speaking about Barrett's paper.
Are there any other questions? But if not, let's thank Francesco again.